This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In Washington County in northeastern North Carolina, a California company is growing a new kind of rice. Ventria Bioscience has engineered the genetics of this rice so that it will grow human proteins that could eventually be used to make sports drinks and medicines to prevent dehydration. Genetically engineered crops are nothing new in North Carolina. Farmers here grow millions of acres of genetically modified corn, soybeans, and cotton every year that have been developed in a way to create bigger yields. But Ventria's rice is experimental, and the fields near Plymouth in Washington County are essentially the test lab. Ventria tried to plant this experimental rice in California and Missouri, but ran into trouble with other business interests there. There was no opposition from North Carolina officials, and the rice was planted near Plymouth. There are, however, some in the state who worry about growing this engineered rice outdoors. Meanwhile, a bill is making its way through the North Carolina legislature that could keep local communities from having any say in whether such crops are grown nearby. And today we'll talk about that bill and the ongoing debate over genetically modified foods and what's going on here in North Carolina. We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Is genetic engineering in crops a hope for inventing new medicines and solving world hunger and other issues? Are there concerns about experimenting with them out in the open fields? Joining us first is David Rice, who has reported on the Rice Project for the Winston-Salem Journal. Welcome back, David.
Sure. Great to be here.
Well, you have been out to Washington County to see the rice paddies of this genetically modified rice. Do they look any different from rice that would grow elsewhere?
Well, I'm not sure because there's no rice grown in North Carolina, and I think that's one of the things that attracted the company here. It's easy to portray the company as having followed the path of least resistance after encountering growers in California and Missouri who were resistant to it. But because there's no established rice crop here, I think that's why part of the reason they ended up here.
Mm-hmm. So this is a paddy currently.
It is. I've learned doing this, having not seen rice grown before other than my children. That the reason they use water is to suppress weed growth, and that was something new to me and raises some issues also about water usage and standing water and that sort of thing in eastern North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. So the rice that this company, Ventria Bioscience, is growing here, it has been genetically engineered. So as I understand it, this rice is not rice that would someday be consumed as rice, you know, in sushi rolls or in Rice Krispies or something.
They say they would, I mean, that basically it's pulverized when they harvest it, and then they use various lab processes to extract these two human proteins that they have bred the rice plant to produce. And I think the big use that I think the company has in mind ultimately is a use in rehydration formula, kind of like Pedialyte, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, for treating, you know, diarrhea or vomiting or you know, those sorts of health issues, especially in the third world. When I was speaking with the company's president, he was citing a World Health Organization study that found that 1.9 million children a year die of diarrhea. So
this rice is essentially, it's the delivery system for these are human proteins. These are proteins that occur, whether we know it or not, in our tears and saliva.
Correct. Currently. I mean, they say that the amino acids in the protein are identical to the ones that would be found in mother's milk or saliva or tears.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what the rice is. It's a factory for making that, because of the way they've genetically engineered it. What kind of approval process did Ventria go through to be able to plant this in near Plymouth?
They've gone through a process with USDA, with the Department of Agriculture, to get permission to plant it in North Carolina. They also applied in Missouri and had withdrawn that application, and USDA then approved it, even though they had withdrawn it. And they have also applied for Food and Drug Administration approval separately for use of these proteins, and there are two. and they haven't received that approval yet.
Mm-hmm. Some of the opposition they ran into in Missouri was from the beer maker, Anheuser-Busch.
Right. Yeah, and they, I mean, apparently Anheuser-Busch came out at one point and said, basically, if you plant this rice here, because we buy rice from Missouri, and particularly because we have to market our product to European, to EU consumers, where they're that much more concerned. There's more of a European concern with GMO crops or GMO food. There was a great bit of concern on Anheuser-Busch's part about buying any rice from Missouri if it was put there. And subsequently, they worked out an agreement with Ventria where Ventria said, we won't grow any of this rice within 120 miles of established commercial rice crops.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be getting into this debate later in the hour, but some of this concern had been, if you grow this crop here, it's an experiment, mm-hmm. and you're growing it out in the open, what is to prevent it from making its way to the other rice fields?
That's part of that whole issue of pollen migration in particular. Now, the folks at Ventria point out that the rice crop is, well, I don't want to say unique, but it is different from corn in that it is a self-pollinating plant where the male and female organs of the plant are within the same flower. And unlike corn, the pollen is less likely to migrate or to move very far. And so some of the researchers at NC State who are monitoring this experiment say that they are less worried about pollen migration and especially when there's no other rice here to crossbreed with, than they are about perhaps birds picking up the seed and transporting it through any number of mechanisms.
And what could happen then? The seed could just be, it could find its way somewhere else, and would we have an invasive species on our hands then?
Well, I don't know if they're worried about the next, rice as the next kudzu or what have you, but I think they want to monitor just how other ways that it might be moved, whether by human failure or farm equipment or what have you. The people from the company say they take great pains to make sure the rice stays in its confines, and but I think there's a sense on the part of some critics that might be easy to do with a 70-acre experiment, but if they ramp up to 20 or 30,000 acres, you can't prevent birds from descending and that sort of thing. So there are questions of scale.
Is there also, I think of a rice paddy, and I think of the eastern part of the state, which can be prone to flooding. Is there a concern that
sure.
plants could wash away?
Sure, there is. Yeah.
But there hadn't been opposition to speak of in that area.
Not in that geographic area. It's interesting that in Washington County, as you're well aware, that they have been more concerned with the Navy's plans for an outlying landing field there. And you see signs that say no OLF all over the place in almost every other front yard down there, but you don't see any signs that say no GMO. I mean, there's been very little resistance to this in Washington County, and the farmers have welcomed it. They feel they've been growing GMO crops for years now, whether they're engineered to withstand Roundup as a pesticide or to with BT corn to be resistant to insects, and so they have they're very welcoming and seem to have a fair amount of confidence that they could grow these crops, and I think they view it as, especially with tobacco in decline. Although this isn't particularly a very tobacco-centric part of the state, they view it as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. There has not been that opposition there. How about the idea that this is experimental, though, as opposed to when people have been growing crops that might be soybean, corn, that have gone through the experimental stage someplace else, but this is the laboratory here.
This it is, but it's also planted next to an ag research station where they do a variety of crop research on all sorts of things, and so that's not exactly a foreign idea to the folks in that area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, at the same time this is going on, David Rice, you've been reporting that in Raleigh in the legislature there's a move afoot in a bill that would state for the record that only the Department of Agriculture can say A or nay to such experiments or even such crops growing in North Carolina. What is behind that? This is a move that would say, you know, your local community can't say, your county can't prevent this from happening
right
there.
It's funny how both this bill and the company that planted the rice are from California or have their origins in California. The bill would, it's the State Board of Agriculture that would have the sole authority to ban plants in the state. And I just happened to sit in on a Senate Ag Committee hearing on the bill a month or so ago and was surprised at how much resistance there was to it, especially from organic farmers who were worried that it would limit local communities' ability to regulate what sort of crops are grown near their crops, where, you know, they have to protect them and be able to certify that they're free of any additives of whatever stripe.
What is behind this? Why the move to?
Oh, well, the folks who are behind the bill, I think it's a combination of agricultural interests and biotech interests who know that in California there were three counties that moved last year to try to ban genetically modified crops, and they want to prevent that sort of thing from happening here, to be more receptive to it.
Forestalling it happening here. We are talking with David Rice, reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal, who's been reporting recently about an experiment with rice in Washington County, North Carolina, genetically engineered rice. And we are talking about genetic modification of food. We'll continue our conversation about that, and you can join the conversation, 1-877-962-9862. What are some of the pros and cons of genetically modified crops? Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkova. We are talking today about genetically modified crops and such crops here in North Carolina. A California company, Ventria Bioscience, has recently planted more than 70 acres of genetically modified rice in Washington County. It's an experiment. Meanwhile, more than 3 million acres of genetically modified corn, soybeans, and cotton are already growing in the state, not as experiments, but as part of agriculture. Joining us in the studio today are David Rice, who is a reporter with the Winston-Salem Journal, who has reported on this recently. Also with us is Hope Shand, who is research director at ETC Group in Carrboro. Welcome, Hope.
Thank you.
And Claire Williams is a research professor of biology at Duke University. Welcome, Claire. And we are taking your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. Well, Hope Shand, you have been among the skeptics about doing this experiment with the genetically modified rice in eastern North Carolina, in Washington County. What are your concerns about this?
Well, I think for us, we think basically that it's a very risky business. We don't think it's a viable economic development strategy for North Carolina. And this is not just one experiment. There are many potential field tests that could be done on these pharmaceutical crops. And for us, the bottom line is that pharmaceuticals, vaccines, plastics, and other industrial chemicals should not be grown in genetically modified crops. It isn't possible to contain or control genetically modified organisms that are in open-air experiments. And as a result, many scientists have warned that contamination of the food supply is virtually inevitable. It's going to happen. It already has happened with other experiments.
Well, is your concern about its spreading, it being inadvertently, that this rice that's being grown inadvertently finding its way elsewhere beyond the 70 acres of that plot? Or is it a philosophical objection to the idea of, you know, tinkering with the makeup of rice to grow something? In this case, it would be a human protein.
I don't think it's so much just this one field trial, but the fact that there are many experiments going on with pharmaceutical crops, and none of us want to eat cornflakes that are laced with pharmaceuticals. We don't want to eat tofu that contains vaccines. And the risk of contamination is very real. And that's why the National Food Processors Association and the Grocery Manufacturers of America have rigorously opposed the Ventria permit and all other genetically modified food crops that are engineered to produce non-food substances. maybe this Ventria pharmaceutical protein will be a beneficial product, but it hasn't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And the problem that we have is not with this specific product, but the fact that why don't they produce it in fermentation or cell culture, but not in open-air experiments, because the risk is just too great. I think we've almost understated the amount of controversy that surrounded this field trial request in both Missouri and in California, where they were rejected outright, and that's why Ventria came to the Tar Heel State. And I think it's really important to say that there really wasn't an opportunity for local residents in Washington County or for most North Carolina citizens to weigh in on this experiment unless they read the Federal Register and knew that they were requesting public comments. It was a very brief period. Mm-hmm. I think right after Ventria was forced out of Missouri, they decided to come to North Carolina. The USDA received 607 comments from the public, and this includes scientists and experts in the field. Only 49 of those comments were in favor of this field trial. It was very controversial. Mm-hmm. And the issue isn't just gene flow pollen. It's accidental mixture of the crop.
And just for clarity, you mentioned nobody wants tofu that contains vaccines. That would be growing from soybeans. But as I understand, what they're talking about in this experiment is not to turn the rice. The rice is not something that would end up on people's table. It is something that's going to be, a mash would be made of it, and then they would be pulling out the proteins. That is at least the plan.
In this case, that's right. They would actually, it would be the seed that they would grind up and then use it mm-hmm. as an ingredient.
The rice is essentially a factory for making
this
protein.
That's right. And this is for an unapproved pharmaceutical protein that has not been approved for use in any field.
Mm-hmm. Well, Claire Williams, you are a professor of biology, a research professor there. You've heard some of these concerns. What do you say to that?
I say that this is something that's a topic addressed nationwide. It's the first time I've seen it in North Carolina. I think listeners may not be aware that molecular farming is a distinct part of genetically engineered food crops, and that there are medical aspects, there are industrial enzymes, vaccinations, I think, have been mentioned. Molecular farming using plants is basically using vectors that provide high expression of a given protein. It's only the protein of interest. It's not really the plant. There are other ways of producing high quantities of proteins, recombinant or otherwise. And so this is a test area that can become, I think, prevalent in lots of agricultural states. We're looking at just a bellwether case.
Mm-hmm. Are you surprised that this is the first time that it's happening now and hadn't happened much before this? Or
yes, because there are a number of molecular farming companies. Ventria is only one of many. There have been a number of instances where there have been some contamination or a little bit of concern over gene flow, particularly in the Corn Belt in the Midwestern part of the United States. And molecular farming was underway at that point. So that's something that's happened several years ago.
And just to clarify, when you're talking molecular farming, you're talking about doing the farming to raise those particular
yes,
molecules.
Yes, using plants as protein factories, not as a food supply.
Mm-hmm. And David Rice?
Yeah. I just know, covering state government for the past 10 years, it's been interesting, especially in the last 5 years, to see the state sort of throw its arms open to the biotech industry, you know, and especially with tobacco furniture and textiles in decline, there's been this sort of welcoming of all things bio. I mean, you put bio in front of any word and they go bio gaga in Raleigh. And I'm not sure how many people realize that there are these sorts of, you know, uses of food crops. And I'm not sure, I mean, I think the science, I've heard Dr. Williams say that the science outstrips the debate in a lot of instances here, because you can very quickly get into debates between battling PhDs, and a lot of people have trouble following that. But here's a state that's thrown $60 or $80 million into a training program at the university and community college level for biotech workers, particularly for biomanufacturing or anything else you want to put bio in front of. And this is one of the first instances I know of where people have really, you know, questioned, wait, do we really want to go down this road? And, you know, it's a sort of a new level of debate.
But have there not been, I can recall years ago there was an experiment underway, I might have been through NC State, about raising a particular tobacco plant to grow a certain type of, I believe it was an enzyme, and they thought it might have applications, you know, in shampoo or something. And this is at a time when there was a lot of talk about you have to find a new use for tobacco because it may not be commanding the same price it is now at that point for cigarettes. So these experiments have been going underway. Is the twist that it's a private company right now that's doing this, and it's not just on a research station, Claire Williams?
I don't think it's the fact it's a private company. I think that it's the possibility of medicine in food. And when we look at waterfowl, can the rice be consumed by waterfowl or other kinds of birds? Can it be consumed by rodents? What's the long-term effect on these animals? We don't know. And I don't think it's so much the commercial or objection to a private enterprise as concern for sustainability in the wetlands.
And is that a special concern to you? Because this is rice, because it certainly does grow in wetland. Well, Hope Shan?
I think it's really important to point out one other thing that hasn't come up yet, and that is that several of the scientists, including one from NC State, who expressed serious concerns about the Ventria rice growing in Washington County, raised the concern that a half mile from the experimental plot is a rice quarantine facility. This is where the USDA grows out exotic rice varieties that are imported into the United States. These are absolutely essential for rice breeders all over the country and all over the world because it introduces needed traits and diversity into our commercial rice crop. That quarantine facility is a half mile away from this experiment. And I think in this case that we're talking about these very valuable exotic rice varieties being endangered by the potential spread either through pollen. In this case, a half mile isn't such a large distance.
Mm-hmm. Now, rice, would its pollen spread or not, Claire Williams, if it's a self-pollinating crop?
About 1% of the pollen moves in any self-fertilizing plant. So how far it moves is an open question. It can move on wind currents. I think Ventria has stated that the pollen remains viable for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But I think it's really it's a little less known than that, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I think pollen remains viable under desiccating conditions, warm, hot winds, things like that. It can move a little bit. And it's those long-term dispersal, those long-distance dispersal instance events, those one-time, one-in-a-million events, I think, that Hope's referring to.
Mm-hmm. In the comments that were filed with USDA when Ventria was looking for its permit or applying for its permit, there were a couple of scientists who were involved with the quarantine nursery to try to develop new breeds of rice. And they, as I recall, the comments were, you know, we realize this is a remote possibility, but it is possible. And rice has cross-pollinated with a weedy variety known as red rice. And so remote but possible.
And what was the effect after it crossbred with red rice? Was that?
I think it contaminated some commercial crops. So
okay, let's go to the phones. Jeff joins us from UNC Chapel Hill. Hi, Jeff. I understand you're a biology professor.
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi. It's been a great program so far. All of your guests have had a lot of good things to say. I'd just like to add a couple of things, one of which was just touched on, this notion of transgenic plants going feral or spreading in the environment. Your guest alluded to the fact that the seed can spread. This is true, but seed spread is very, very rare. There was a study published in Nature several years ago looking at transgenic brassica, transgenic potato, transgenic corn, and one other which escapes my memory right now. They looked at persistence in the soil at a variety of places around the UK, and essentially what they found is that our cultivated plants are wimps. They don't compete out with weeds, and they don't live very long. Now, the UK has also just finished a large study to try to determine what constraints might be placed on release of transgenic plants. And one recommendation that came up, because they have lots of wild relatives of what's called rapeseed and brassica relatives, they do have lots of wild relatives of that growing in the UK. So the recommendation was, well, we won't plant transgenic rapeseed in the UK because of the spread issue. And this is the reason that California and Missouri were upset about the potential of this rice trial. So there are logical ways to approach the problem. And I think the decision to move this trial to North Carolina, where we don't cultivate rice, is probably, in fact, a very wise one. The people can monitor its persistence around those fields for several years, and I'm willing to bet that there will be essentially none.
What about its presence near the research station?
Well, so the half mile, you know, there's got to be data that shows how long that pollen stays viable and how far it spreads. This has been done for rice, for transgenic corn. It's been done also for soybean and for cotton. I think the general attitude is that for most crops, there is an idiosyncratic amount of spread. By the way, that's the same spread of a non-transgenic crop of the same species, right? Mm-hmm. So the rice varieties that are being grown in this all-important germplasm center are surely cross-contaminating each other at a much, 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 much higher frequency than they would be contaminated by pollen coming from the transgenic pest field. Moreover, as the reporter, I'm sorry, I'm bad with names, alluded to earlier, rice is actually very difficult to outcross even in a lab. So the notion that you would have any kind of risky spread of pollen, I think in this case, is very, very small.
What about the idea, though, Claire Williams raised it a second ago, and that is, never mind the idea of it spreading to this rice spreading to grow outside of the experimental area, but say, you know, some critter intaking the rice, or eating the rice.
And digesting it.
And digesting it, or something perhaps happening to the animal because it's been changed?
So I would imagine that animals eat proteins from various sources all the time, some of which they're used to and some of which they're not, like maybe our garbage. I don't see that this is an issue. You digest most of the proteins that you're fed anyway. That's how you get amino acids to make your own proteins.
Okay, well, I'm going to let Claire Williams, did you want to respond to that?
Yes. This particular recombinant protein is lactoferrin. It's stable at low pH or low acidity conditions, and it's also stable under high temperatures. It resists a lot of proteolytic activity.
And so what does that mean for...
Well, it means that it's active in the gut.
Oh.
It doesn't get digested very easily. It's a component of human breast milk. Tears, saliva, I think you mentioned that.
Okay. Well, Jeff, thank you for your call.
Yep. Okay. Good luck.
Hope Shand.
Well, I just want to add that, unfortunately, the track record of many of these pharmaceutical companies growing in plants is not a good track record. And there have been accidents, there have been human mistakes made, and I think those need to be considered as well. In 2002, this company, Prodigene, their pharmaceutical corn adulterated 500,000 bushels of soybeans in Nebraska and 155 acres of corn in Iowa. And ultimately, these adulterated crops were seized. They were destroyed, but the cleanup cost millions of dollars. The company essentially went out of business. Earlier this year, it was disclosed that biotech company Syngenta had, and this is not a pharmaceutical crop, but a genetically modified crop, had inadvertently sold an unapproved strain of genetically modified corn to U.S. farmers for a period of up to 4 years. It's not the first time that this has happened. In this case, Europe wants to keep out this unlicensed, unapproved strain, and it threatened to boycott U.S. corn imports valued at $347 million. And in this case, it's the farmers who suffer the consequences.
Okay, we'll go to the phones, and Scott is with us from Chatham County. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, welcome to the program. Did
you
have a question?
Much. Well, I had a comment. You raised earlier the issue of the genetically engineered tobacco a couple of years ago, and I think it's really important to note that genetically engineered tobacco was opposed by the tobacco growers in North Carolina because of the exact fears that we're talking about of contamination and the fact that it could get into the markets, and that then this that the liability for the possibility of contamination would then lay on the farmer, not on the company. I think it's a significant issue to bring up that this is consistently sold as a great thing for farmers. But what we've seen with genetically engineered products is that consistently the companies will not take any kind of liability for the possibility of contamination, the possibility of any kind of damages caused by them, any of the ramifications of all the different issues we've been bringing up today. The other part of that is that this is highly speculative that, you know, they keep throwing around this 10 or 20,000 acres of a new crop and for farmers in eastern North Carolina. That is, you know, if they are successful at doing this process, if they get it approved by the FDA, if they can turn it into a marketable product, if they can sell that product and do it, then maybe at some point, 10, 15 years down the line, there might be some possibility of more extensive production.
Okay. Well, David Rice, did you want to respond?
Well,
Scott?
Just to on the backlash from the tobacco farmers, I wrote about some of that, and I think we might be confusing a couple of different instances or experiments here. I do know that 5 or 6 years ago, when Bennett LeBeau and the Liggett group wanted to produce a low nicotine, or they actually called it a no nicotine cigarette, and LeBeau, who wasn't highly regarded in the tobacco industry because of giving away secrets to the feds, was trying to get farmers here to grow the nicotine-free tobacco, or at least I called it low litigation tobacco. The tobacco farmers got a legislator who is now involved with the bill in the legislature here to file a bill that would have banned genetically modified tobacco in North Carolina, and the bill never went anywhere. It caused a stir for a while, and there was a backlash from the biotech industry saying, whoa, you know, we use the tobacco plant. It's, you know, the white rat of the biotech industry and that sort of thing. So, and I think that explains part of the corporate behavior here. There are rice growers in California. There are rice growers in Missouri. There's no one who grows rice here, and we didn't see that backlash this time like we did with the Liggett tobacco a few years ago.
We're talking this hour about genetically modified plants and crops and transgenic crops in North Carolina. With us are David Rice, who is a reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal. Claire Williams is a research professor of biology at Duke University. And Hope Shand is a research director at the ETC Group in Carrboro. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment about genetically modified crops here in North Carolina. The number is 1-877-962-9862. 1-877-962-9862 if you want to join the conversation here on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and we are talking today about genetically modified crops. Crops such as corn, soybeans, and cotton have been growing for several years in North Carolina, crops that whose genes have been tinkered with in some way or other, perhaps to get a bigger yield for those crops. But there is also, at the moment, an experiment with a genetically engineered rice in Washington County near the town of Plymouth. This is a rice that would create certain proteins that are normally found in humans. The whole point of this would be someday to perhaps create products with that protein, products such as rehydrating formula and sports drinks. We are joined this hour by Hope Shand. She is research director at ETC Group in Carrboro, a skeptic of such efforts. Claire Williams is a research professor of biology at Duke University. David Wright is a reporter with the Winston-Salem Journal who has been writing about all of this. And we are taking your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. And joining our conversation right now is David McLeod, who is general counsel at the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Welcome to The State of Things, David McLeod.
Thank you.
Hi. Well, what process did this California company, Ventria Biosciences, what did they go through in order to, do they have to seek some kind of permission from the state of North Carolina in order to plant these 70-plus acres of their genetically engineered rice near Plymouth?
Now, that process is regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and this, we are involved in a limited way in that when permit applications come in, the USDA sends a copy of the application to our plant pest folks, and we have the opportunity to review and comment on those applications.
The plant pest folks, what do they do?
They regulate any plants that are causing problems in the state. Mm-hmm. You know, the plants that have the potential to become a nuisance or a plant pest. Mm-hmm. But no additional permit is required from the state.
Right. Well, we've heard some anxiety that some folks have about genetically modified crops in North Carolina. Experiments such as this one, if you've been listening this hour, what do you make of those? How would you respond to some of those concerns?
I guess what we would say is that all the 3 million acres of GMO crops that North Carolina farmers are growing now, at some stage, went through that experimental process. They had to come from the laboratory out into the field for field tests, and they went through that process, and now we've got over 200 million acres of genetically engineered crops grown in the country. So, there is a process, and the process seems to work from our standpoint.
Okay. Well, speaking of process, there's also a bill in the General Assembly this session that would give more control to the State Board of Agriculture and would say that local communities could not have a say in whether such experiments or even such crops were grown within their borders. Why does the Board of Agriculture want that kind of change?
Well, we don't view it so much of a change as a clarification. The Board of Agriculture has had the authority to regulate plants and plant pests for over 100 years now. And genetically modified plants are regulated at the federal level. If they cause problems, we can regulate them at the state level. So we don't really see that local regulation is necessary. There are no existing county ordinances regulating plants in North Carolina, none proposed that I'm aware of. And so this bill just stands for the simple proposition that counties should not have the authority to tell farmers what kind of crops they can grow.
Mm-hmm. David McLeod is general counsel at the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Hope Shan, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think in our view that this bill to eliminate options for local authority over plants and seeds isn't necessary. I mean, This local preemption bill is part of a nationwide campaign by the biotechnology industry. As we mentioned earlier, this happened because of concerns about California prohibiting growing of genetically modified crops in three counties. And I think, you know, state legislators who support this bill are really responding more to the needs of the biotech industry and not to North Carolina citizens. And to me, the question is, why shouldn't local communities have the right to participate in the democratic process? Why, you know, this bill really is about muting public concerns over biotech, and unfortunately that's been typical of the industry's history.
Did you want to respond to that, David McLeod?
Well, I'd just say there are lots of areas that are regulated by the state and not through the preemption of the county, such as occupational licensing, things where you have state boards that have staff and expertise in a particular area. And it's just not practical, and really doesn't make sense to have 100 counties and I don't know how many cities imposing an additional layer of regulations, because there's always opportunity for input with the state agency that's involved.
Okay. Alice joins us on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
Hi. Did you have a comment?
Yes. I mentioned this a minute ago to the person who answered the phone, and I just wanted to comment that I'm disappointed that there isn't any representation really objectively from the side that would be supportive of the field trial that's going on. I understand that
we asked the company to be here, and they declined.
Venturia wasn't able to be there, but as was mentioned, this state is full of biotech people, so it seems to me that it would be possible to find somebody to replace them.
Well, if you could stand in for them, what would you say?
I'm not going to stand in for them because it wouldn't be my role, but I think that it should be stated that the USDA does have a very stringent permitting process in place. They do take into consideration specifically the concerns, many of which have been brought up today, and they do consider those concerns and they take them into account before they issue a permit. These are experimental trials, and as such, they are subject to permitting by the USDA. And I think there's a lot of speculation going on in the program today without any facts to back those up. And I don't think that you can make any huge conclusions based on the conversations that are going on because of the lack of expertise supporting that.
Well, Claire Williams, thank you for your call. Alice, actually, David Rice first.
Yeah, I spent a fair amount of time talking with the president of the company, and I mean, I don't mind repeating what he said, that, you know, they're confident that, you know, their methods will contain the rice, that none of the rice comes outside the dike or levee that they've built around the plot. They use dedicated equipment and that sort of thing, and they just don't. They even used a dedicated ditch and dedicated water that go only to this plot. So that, you know, they seem, of course, very confident that they can do this safely, and they also feel very heavily regulated by USDA. Of course, that confidence may disappear, you know, with the first. I mean, we are playing with the fear of the unknown here in a lot of respects. Or, you know, you can't always predict human error. Mm. So, you know, I mean, people do need to acknowledge that. And on the bill in the legislature, I mean, part of it boils down to a political question of, I mean, it would be interesting if we had a Republican state house, because Republicans are so fond of stressing local control. And it would be interesting to see how they would respond to a bill like this, because it would really pose a problem for them, or a philosophical problem, or at least with their rhetoric. I've spoken with Senator Basnight, the president pro tem in the Senate, about this, and he's an interesting figure in all this, because he has clearly backed the state's investments in biotech. Washington County is in his district, and he's also in the process of trying to find a supplier of organic chicken for his restaurant at the Outer Banks, and so he's talking about a lot of this and trying to see some sort of coexistence between organic growers, biotech growers, and conventional growers. And, you know, it is a balancing act, and what I sense in the ag community is, you know, yes, this stuff has to be treated with respect, but we feel confident that we can do it.
Claire Williams? I think Alice might be raising a good and useful point here, but Alice, I would say that biotechnology has received heavy investment in North Carolina. It's a maturing industry, and we're seeing the fruits of that investment. But there, all biotech isn't good and all biotech isn't bad. What we need to be doing is picking and choosing our portfolio as a state, and every state's going to have to do this. We're in a unique state in that we are a tobacco-growing state. Many farmers have taken the buyout. We're looking at the next 10 years as being a tremendous time of experimentation, and we have to be careful of national legislation that moves against local markets. And I think we need a public outlet for dialogue. And Alice, you need to be part of that. We need to find a way at this point of our maturing industry to get out there and have town meetings where we hear pros and cons.
Alice, well, thank you so much for your call. And we go to Janet Cal right now. Janet is a state senator from Wake County. Hi there.
Hey.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I did. I think in the Senate we've had a pretty robust debate on this bill, the banning local control of plants, and my goal is that we can have a coexistence of biotechnology and organics. I mean, my district represents, you know, I have a biotech center in my district, and I'm very proud to have that here. It's a great resource for the state, but I also have a lot of consumers where I have a new EarthShare organic supermarket opening up. And so, you know, I think there is a path to coexistence, but very important to that path is having public input. And I want to build on the comments of Hope Shand and Claire Williams that, you know, to me the biggest negative of this bill that's been in the legislature is it doesn't paint a picture of how the public is going to have input. Right now we don't have an organic representative on the Board of Agriculture, nor do we have a consumer advocate. So how is that going to happen? And I don't want to cut off that debate before we've figured that out.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the prospects are for this bill to get through this session, as written right now?
Well, Senator Alberson, who I have great respect for, who sponsored the bill, and I have talked along with Senator Basnight and David McLeod, who was also on the program, about some sort of a compromise bill where the bill might move forward, but yet we would have a study bill to really look at the broader issue of coexistence. The state of Oregon, as an example, has organic canola for food crops and then GMO canola, and they have almost agricultural zones where local farmers have input into where it can be grown. You know, is something like that appropriate for North Carolina? That's what the study bill would do. And then we've also proposed potentially having that organic and consumer representation on the State Board of Agriculture.
Okay. Well, Janet Cowell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Janet Cowell is a state senator representing Wake County. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. Tom is with us from Garner. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing today?
Okay, welcome.
Well, I'd like to make a few comments, if I could, to address several of the issues that were raised.
Sure.
The representative from Wake County, it's kind of ironic because there's very few farms, if any, left in Wake County. So I don't think really that's much of an issue for GMO crops.
But there are other biotech firms, as she pointed out, there, and a lot of consumers who are going for organics.
I am a small-scale organic farmer. I farm part-time, and I work a full-time job. But I think there's this perception that organic farmers are against all this stuff, and they are, because they're concerned for the long term what these crops might do to the environment, or the food supply. But I think if you stop and look at really what could be more beneficial to the state, period, is that the state made a big push to have a larger percentage of food grown, or food that's consumed in the state, grown here. You look at states like California. There's a book that came out about a year or so ago on the history of California agriculture, and I think the statistic they said was that 99% of California's food is imported, or exported.
Mm-hmm.
So nearly everything that California grows goes out of that state, and I think that's why you see the GMO debate in California in these three counties to ban it, starting there because they have such a huge agricultural base in that state. And here we have, I think, in my opinion, very little in the way of food-based crops, and only in just commodity crops, whether it's pigs or corn or tobacco or cotton or soybeans or sweet potatoes or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the State Department of Agriculture could make a better effort, instead of courting GMO crops, to get farmers to grow, instead of four or five crops, grow 10, 20, 30 crops like I might grow in the course of a season.
Well,
and market direct to the communities. I live in just on the edge of Johnston County. We're in one of the fastest growing areas in the state, and there's very few farmers markets here in this area.
Okay, first David Rice, and then David McLeod.
Yeah, I had a question for you. Is the concern here as far as the GMO backlash in California the fact that you know, we do live in a global marketplace and there's less acceptance of GMO, you know, especially in Europe?
Tom?
I don't know. I look at it from the practical standpoint of GMO crops don't affect what I grow. I grow heirloom tomatoes, lettuce, you name it. Everything that you can go into a store and buy, I grow that. And in my opinion, GMO corn doesn't affect me. Rice doesn't affect me, which doesn't mean I shouldn't be concerned. But what's the larger picture? The GMO industry is trying to court big, huge farms that grow monocrops that, you know, sure, it can contaminate the food supply, but...
Okay, well, I'm going to let Hope Shand respond to that. Hope?
Well, I just want to make the point, and perhaps you are a certified organic farmer, but USDA's federal organic standards forbid the use of genetically modified seeds. So organic farmers risk losing organic certification in markets in the event of unintended gene flow or contamination.
And quickly before we go, David McLeod, is that the effort in North Carolina to go for those very large fields that are grown, or as Tom is saying, or is there an effort as well to have more of that diversity in smaller fields?
Well, you know, North Carolina is, I think I recall this correctly, the third most agriculturally diversified state in the country. So just about anything that can be grown in this climate, we grow it here. If the department's webpage promotes organic produce, we've got organic growers at all the farmers markets, Raleigh, Asheville, Charlotte, Lumberton, and a lot of local farmers markets too. So there is a lot of diversity here, and there's still a lot of farming here in the Triangle area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even one example, even in Orange County, you've got 3,000 acres of soybeans, mm-hmm. and probably 75% to 90% of those are GMO soybeans.
Okay. Well, David McLeod, thank you for being with us. It sounds like we also have an ongoing debate about the genetically modified crops here in North Carolina, but I'd like to thank you all for being with us today to talk about that. David McLeod is General Counsel at the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Hope Shand is Research Director at ETC Group in Carrboro. David Rice is a reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal. And Claire Williams is a Research Professor of Biology at Duke University. And that's the state of things for today. If you have a comment about the program, the email address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Melinda Pencava.